July 11th, 1996. Part two of the Brickner interview. Part one was July 13th, 1995. Yeah. 1 year later.
Don't expect me to come in on my own time to finish this. So we better keep this in 1996. You're in serious shit here.
I'm going to have to pay you to come in. Let's see. We talked about your life when you were younger. Even have, let's see, Oakland, Illinois.
Oakland, Illinois?
That's what it looks like it says. But
no.
August 4th, 28, Oakdale.
Oakdale. Hope, hope, hope. As in Hope Springs Eternal.
Oak.
Hopedale, Ohio.
Isn't that wild? That's how, well, Ohio.
Right.
Visiting from Pittsburgh. Not part of it, right?
We were actually we were living in Pittsburgh. My mother visited her mother in Hopedale, and I was born while she was visiting.
What's that mean?
I'm an accidental Buckeye, is what
there
I...
There you go. And you probably said that. I just wrote it too quick. Yeah. Anyways, we talked about your childhood, moving to Buffalo when you were three, about Sounds your dad's working at Sikorsky.
Curtis is where he got fired from. But then he tried to get a job at Sikorsky, and he was blacklisted. You're right. Keep going. I'm sure it's all on the tape. You got more or less the right life here.
Let's see. Your first job was Buffalo Cooperative Department Store?
Grocery store. Buffalo Cooperative. Yo!
George Haglin?
Okay, I was reviewing what we had covered last time.
That's all the further we got, John.
No. Then, got you working. And all I said is your first job, Buffalo Co-op Department Store, a second job, a third job, something at Antioch, laborer and Gary, a hooker loading boxcars, Cleveland Plain dealer, got you into the newspaper business, got you running through there to St. Louis.
The Teamsters,
got you in Cleveland at the 49th CIO convention.
Where they kicked out the UE. I was hired by the newspaper guild, don't tell them, as an organizer.
Oh, got you leaving IUE in August 50, getting married, spending a year in Antioch. Grad assistant at the Labor Relations Center.
UCLA.
Going to Cornell.
Then Indiana. Oh, we're at Indiana.
Cornell Econ PhD program, didn't get degree. Went to IU to work as faculty. IU did lots of summer schools for unions with LERC. Whit Murphy was the director. Resident labor education program.
Oh, we did get that in.
Charlie Ellinger was a USWA student.
Right.
You ran it for 3 years.
Right. Well, we got all that done.
You gave me some Whit Murphy stories.
Right.
Hig Roberts, Terry Connors, Haynes Turner, you dropped those names. ULEA was an old boys club with Whit, Hive, Rutgers guy, Herb Levine, talking on the phone, no staff input.
Right.
Directors of Labor Ed formed ULEA. Was a 189 member union card when kicked out of AFT, I left. And that's where we stop the tape.
Okay.
So is there more IU stories we should do?
Not that I know of.
Oh. Want to talk about being hired at Michigan State?
Sure.
Okey-doke.
You don't have any of the politics in Bloomington, though, right?
No.
You want that, or that makes no difference?
Sure. Why don't you
care. I really don't give a damn.
What you did?
Because I was, unlike Michigan, I was very active in politics.
Doing what?
Well, I ran three congressional campaigns. I ran the city campaign that elected a completely, threw out every Republican that was on city council and the mayor.
Well, on stand?
Huh? Oh, yeah.
No handshake?
Huh?
No handshake?
Well, they didn't know how to take care of me, John. They didn't. There was no supervision.
I see. So you were on your own?
I was on my own. I was the supervision, and I didn't care. No, part of the reason that I got away with it was because Jamie Murphy, Whit's wife, was a Democratic county clerk in Monroe County. So that
political activity was part of the functioning of the mm-hmm. labor center there, because everyone was so goddamn political. I mean, you know, Whit mm-hmm. was married to the county clerk, and uh-huh. Jamie was, when I left, Jamie was the county chairman.
Okay.
Because just 2 years before I left, uh-huh. we had the city elections, which I managed, and we just threw out every Republican, from the mayor, the city clerk, and every member of the council was
now, this is Bloomington.
Turned over, yeah,
okay.
in Bloomington.
At that time, was everybody at Bloomington, or was the regional Gary structure, et cetera?
No, that was one of my, that was my invention right before I left. Wow. I had always argued that we were sitting down there in the hillbilly hills mm-hmm. on campus, and that we really needed a presence in the industrial centers of the state. So I came up with this, well, what amounted to a plan, a development plan that said if we got more staff, instead of bringing them to Bloomington, we would confine Bloomington to two things. One was running the huge number of week-long institutes that we ran. We used to average 13 a year.
Wow.
And I ran them all. So I was an expert on summer institutes.
Were all
like
those
it.
In the summertime then, pretty much?
They started in usually May, and they were over with by Labor Day. So we'd get June, July, and August. We'd run probably 12 weeks at minimum, sometimes as many as 15 weeks in that length of time. We had what's now Graphic Communications would always come in. CWA would come in. We'd always get 2 weeks of steel workers, 2 weeks of auto workers. CWA always came to Michigan State for the Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois region.
Think they served the labor movement well?
Well, the firefighters, I ran the first mm-hmm. firefighters conference. Did I ever tell you the funny story about, mm-hmm. oh, you want funny stories?
Sure.
I ran the first conference that the International Association of Firefighters ever ran on a national basis after they got their first education director, whose name escapes me, but uh-huh. he had been kicking around the field for a long uh-huh. time in unions. And he came in to plan the program. And this will interest you. The inheritance, we can pin this down, had been on the market for 6 to 8 months. It was a new product uh-huh. at that time. So we're talking, what, 1965, maybe 4 or 5, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. So he said, why don't you show the inheritance? I saw it in Washington, and I think it's a really great film. Mm-hmm. So, and he said, why don't we use that as the opening for the first night? And I said, fine. And he said, will you lead a discussion on it? And I said, sure. I said, do you want to do it? Or he said, could we have a discussion after we see the film? And I said, well, do you want to do the discussion, or you want me to do it? And he said, oh, why don't you do it? And I said, okay. So I sort of explained what the film was. You know, we did the usual labor education song and dance. Shut off the movie. And I said probably a few words. And I said, any reactions? How do you feel about the film? Or whatever, words to that effect. The first person that raised his hand was a guy who said, well, I like the film, most of the film, except when you got into the stuff that didn't have anything to do with unions. And I was thinking, what is the stuff that doesn't have anything to do with unions? And of course, I was thinking instantly about the civil rights stuff that's in there toward the end, you know. And I said, well, what do you mean? Or something like that. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, you saw that film in there? Well, those were my boys hosing down them niggers on the streets. So this was a guy who, you know how the firefighters are. They have captains,
sure.
lieutenants, you know.
Yeah.
This guy was a captain in whatever it was, the Montgomery
uh-huh.
Fire Department or something
yeah.
like that. And he was the commanding officer when they were putting the fire hoses on the,
yeah.
the Black Civil Rights March in wherever it was, Montgomery or Selma.
Yeah.
I can't remember which mm-hmm. of the ones that's in the film. And I have never, or rarely, frozen in front of an audience, but how do you deal with that was a really interesting question. And fortunately, I was saved by other firefighters.
Uh-huh.
Now, I would say the audience was
98% white.
100%. We're talking 60s. I mean, I don't think there was a black firefighter in the entire United States unless they were in the Delta of Mississippi where they had nothing but blacks in the town or something like that, you know. But, you know, much to my amazement, the urban white guys
took this guy on. And we got into a really good discussion. We didn't change his mind about niggers, you know, but that was one of the rare, you know, it was like, under the heading of being punched right between the eyes, I did not expect anything like that. You know, you can have plenty of racists in a class or something, and they'll sort of shut up or know that they're out of order or better not express their opinion. But that was one of the things that it's really vivid in my mind what happened that night, because there he was. I mean, he was in the film. He didn't say, "I'm in the film." He just said, "I'm a mob boy." You know? Very interesting experience. But getting back to the point is, of course, that we had a reputation for running on-campus programs, and we just kept doing, and we just, you know, anyone in Washington, someone said, where can you go and run a, you know, where they have the facilities and all this experience running on, you know, and everyone, we get plumbers, and actually we did have the plumbers once, not for the kind of program we're doing here, but we got more referrals than we wanted. Then, by contrast, and one of the reasons I mentioned this was that when I came here, I had talked to Fred Haler before I even had any idea I was coming here. When he was down talking about the Nile program and all that sort of thing, when we were running the resident program, and he mentioned, and I sort of remembered it, that, well, we don't run any summer programs at Michigan State, Fred said. Because my staff doesn't want to do it. And he was amazed, you know, that we worked like crazy all summer long. You know, we had to mobilize every troop we could find and every faculty member we could recruit to teach speech skills and communication skills and all that kind of stuff. So it was a crazy operation all summer long. I would say it was probably the busiest time of the year for us, given where we were. It was running summer institutes and 3 and 4 day conferences and all that kind of stuff. But getting back to the original point, which was politics, during the Vietnam thing, we had all kinds of people popping up as candidates running, wanting to run for office because they were, you know, how things were on campus during the Vietnam War. Terry Connors ran for Congress in the 7th District, and I was his treasurer. Bob Jeffrey, who was a friend of mine in speech and theater, and did a lot of teaching for us. I was his campaign manager. He tried to get the Democratic nomination because we had Terre Haute in our district.
Okay.
And Terre Haute was a pretty big union town at the time. And then we had Vincennes and all those towns down along the river, which were fairly industrialized on the Wabash. And then it came over as far as Bloomington and picked up Monroe County. Generally, I shouldn't say generally, it was a switch county, but we could carry it for the Democratic Party and if we in a good year. That district, often it didn't for a long time when we were first there, had a Republican from Martinsville who represented the district. But then when he retired, it almost went up for grabs because there was a lot of name recognition with the Republican, and we got a Democrat in and, into that district. And Frank McCloskey, the guy I got elected mayor of Bloomington, was the congressman from that district for about 5 terms after I left. So he got wiped out in the last election. And he was mayor 2 terms, which means 4 8-years from 72, so that means 80. He must have run for Congress in 80, and he was there from 80 to 92? That's when the Republicans took over? Yeah. So that's 6 terms, right? You might remember Frank was 1 vote McCloskey. Remember they had that big contested election like three cycles back?
Vaguely.
And he had lost by 2 votes, and then they recounted and he'd won by 1.
Okay.
And the Democratic Congress seated him even though his Republican opponent had won by 1 vote. Well, Frank was the guy I got elected. He had been a newspaper reporter in town, and he ran for, worked for the Herald Telephone, ran for state rep and lost. But I sort of have the reputation on campus for being able to mobilize the whole the whole IU campus for political purposes. But the point of the thing was that the year after the city election we had, that was 72. The city election was 71, and 72 was the Nixon landslide.
And I ran for county commissioner on the basis of all the exposure I got the previous year in the city election. And I was one of two Democrats that won in Monroe County. The Republicans carried everything else. And Indiana, Nixon had the highest plurality of any place in the United States in Indiana, so you can tell how he took Indiana. I mean, we just got wiped out. But there was one state rep seat, which was largely urban. Didn't have some of the county areas in it, which we were able to carry. And I came out of Bloomington 9, which was a student district with such a plurality that even though I lost a majority of the townships, I won the election by landslide, by 218 votes for the county. Of course, I was a non-hero a year later when having gotten on the county as a county commissioner. And in Indiana, there are only three county commissioners, and they have all the legislative and executive functions in the county, so it was no mean operation. And it paid, what? I made another, well, it must have been $500 a month, I guess, because it added $6,000 to my salary, I know. So I was making about 19-something at IU plus six. One of my bargaining chips here for getting as much money as I did was I said I have to give up two jobs to come to Michigan State. So they paid me $26,500 to come here for my opening salary, because I was making, the sum of my salaries down there was about $1,000 less than that. So.
You said what kind of a hero?
Huh?
You used a funny term. You were a funny kind of a hero.
I was an anti-hero, because the Democrats thought, well, we've got Brickner in on the county as a county commissioner, and then a year later I took a job in Michigan and left. I was not a hero with the Democrats when I left, because everyone had worked hard to get me elected as a commissioner, and then I said, sorry folks, I'm going to go to Michigan, and I had to resign as a county commissioner.
Did you ever run into trouble that what you thought was right and what the unions thought was right ever clashed? And
there wasn't that much. The biggest problem we had with the unions was trying to make them liberal. I hate to tell you this, but when McGovern was running, all the union people were blatantly against McGovern. And we were running around selling McGovern at local union meetings, not in our robes as labor educators, but as fellow Democratic activists, because none of them were going to vote for McGovern. Mm-hmm. They were off the hook, and all those wild, crazy kids on campus, and the whole syndrome that went on.
Well, exactly.
And
I was curious if that ever came back.
Oh no, I sort of survived that. I mean, okay. I didn't do nearly as well in working class areas of the county as I did in the heavily university areas, but I would squeak through. I mean, I'd do better than most Democrats would in those areas. Yeah.
Okay.
They eventually forgave me for Vietnam.
But there weren't issues where they came in and talked to.
Oh, they were pissed off. They were pissed off. Like I was a state convention delegate, and there was just all kinds of heat on us not to support McCarthy. And I went up and I bolted from the delegation. And then I was one of the people who sued the state Democratic Party for shoving the nomination down our throat, because we went into a congressional district caucuses is how they determine who went to the national convention. And we had a candidate, Dave, what was Dave's last name? Can't remember, but he was a local attorney. Dave Rogers, very well respected, had been a Democrat for years. His father, he had been a Democratic something or other, state representative for 8 or 10 terms, and then came back to Bloomington to practice law. And Dave agreed to run as our candidate, as a McCarthy candidate at the convention. They wouldn't even let us nominate him. They just walked in and said, here are the nominees. I tried to nominate him. They wouldn't even recognize me. They simply said, here's the vote, boom, and walked out. But I made a lot of enemies in the state party as a result of that. But
didn't get in trouble in the labor ed?
No.
Taking positions opposite.
Actually, we had a lot of very rational labor people. Dal Sells was a very liberal guy for the UAW, and he, at that time, well, it was on the cusp. Early on, he was also president of the state Fed before the UAW disaffiliated, and then he left as state Fed president. But the steelworkers, which of course was actually the largest union in Indiana, in terms of membership, not the, unlike Michigan, where it's the UAW, had really great people. And since I'd run their resident program for them, and they loved the resident program, mm-hmm. I had terrific credibility with them. So, you know, they'd say, oh, you goddamn pinko liberal, yeah. You know, and but it was all in good, you know, you're okay. Mm-hmm. The UAW people, half of them agreed with us. I mean, mm-hmm. they weren't on board with the AFL-CIO position on the war anyway, you know, so they mm-hmm. loved it. Right. They thought it was just more fun than could possibly be imagined. So,
well, as we both know, there have been stories in Michigan's labor stories around university labor ed where the labor movement hasn't always sat out if the staff has different opinions
than labor leaders
do. So yeah. That's why I was curious.
Yeah, and that's... Well, yeah, I think that's true. There's always a 10% notch there for personality, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, previous battles and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And I think some people can get away with more than other people can, depending on mm-hmm. how they were perceived before the event and after the event. Mm-hmm. And yes, I know what you're talking about.
Well, I was also some of my own.
Yeah, I know, so I know. Yeah, sure.
While we're on Indiana, I sort of asked you while you were saying other things, if you want to make any comment about the value of summer residential programs, because we don't do them so much anymore, but it used to be.
Well, I think the legitimate, you know, I think Harry Lester has a point. They're very expensive forms of education, you know, and if uh-huh. they can, if they have the kind of university like we have, that will go out in the communities and provide labor education for them there. It's expensive from our point of view. From their point of view, it's cheap as hell because they don't have all the lost time, and B, they don't have all the cost of bringing these people in and paying for board and room. But at that point, you see, I think what's really changed, John, is the economics of the situation. Unions, quite frankly, in Indiana were rolling in dough at that time, mm-hmm. and I suspect they were here too. I mean, we were in the 60s and the boom just kept going on and on and on and on. And, well, just to give you an example, Carol used to say, Carol and all the wives in LEP down there, our equivalent of LEP, right. LERC, used to consider the steel workers 2 weeks the height of the social season because Jim Robb, who was the regional director of the steelworkers, held us in some degree of reverence. I mean, we did a great job, and we really put out, we got good people, and, you know, we were duly reverential with respect to Jim, who was an old, he was a real fossil in the sense that he was a Phil Murray-type coal miner, and he had been, you know, in that district, in the Indiana district. He came out of the coal mines over uh-huh. south of Terre Haute, and then he was put in as district director, and great guy. I mean, terrific guy, but except for being very thin and wiry, he looked like something like John L. He had the big bushy uh-huh. eyebrows, the black eyebrows, and he always wore cufflinks, even when he took his coat off, you know, he had these big cufflinks. He had a cufflink fetish. His wife told me after he retired that he would come down in the morning with his shirt, tie, and cufflinks on and had no place to go, you know, after he retired from the directorship. But they would take us out and give us, at the end of the 2 weeks of summer school, and we would have a banquet, and they would always call each instructor up and hand him an envelope which had $50 in it, which was sort of a tip. Yeah, it really was. You know, we would get steak and, you know, everything, anything you wanted at the best hotel in Bloomington. And it was, you know, God, everyone got dressed up in their finest bib and tucker, you know, and it was a real show and tell. The auto workers always had a much more proletarian approach, uh-huh. but they would still, you know, they would invite all the wives to a function, you know, usually the picnic, and we'd just have these incredibly good picnics. We had a place called Pick-A-Chick right outside town where they had ribs and chicken, and they had a baseball field and a horseshoe pitching things, and you know, and it was a privately catered place where they killed the mosquitoes before you got there, things like that. And they'd throw a lot of money in these things. I mean, they no holds barred. If you said we needed videotape machines, this, that, and the other thing, they'd say, put it on the bill. You know, I mean.
Well, besides the enjoyment of the.
Well, getting back to the original point, is, I think, basically.
Did they serve the unions well?
Oh, I think so, because what we were able to do in a collective bargaining class, which was what I was teaching most of in those days, was give us an opportunity to have these people all day long, and if you were doing a role play, you could walk in at 8:30 in the morning or 9, whenever it started, after the general session, and you could really do some really intensive training all day long. I mean, if they were there, they were there for like 27 or 28 hours of nothing but collective bargaining. You do a really intricate role play, and we developed a whole bunch of them. We developed some intricate role plays for arbitration, where we'd bring them in and split them up and let them argue the grievance all the way through to arbitration and then arbitrate it, because you had so damn much time, you know, and we'd videotape everything. We'd have plenty of time to critique it. We'd allow 2 hours of playback for every hour that we were on with the arbitration case. And they got very serious about it. We'd bring Fred Whitney over, you know, to sit in as arbitrator, and we'd really play it right up the gazoo. The guy, the management people in particular, would show up in their suits and ties on the morning we were going to do the case. So I think there's a lot to be said. It's like, can you get as good an education? I think it's probably extending it from a correspondence course as you can from coming to class and having some dialogue with an instructor. And I think there's some part of that analogy that holds up for the summer, the resident kind of experience. You get to know people better. They sort of trust you more, and you can, I think, teach more effectively.
Frankly. I think we miss it here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, just over the last 20 years of my career. Before leaving all those number of stories, are there any other sort of Vietnam Union stories in labor education? Did it pose much of a challenge otherwise, or raise particular issues?
Well, with the UAW, because they were, you know, policy dissidents with respect to the war, and a few other unions who were similar, CWA was not on board with AFL-CIO policy, and I could sort of go through the ones. Basically, what you did for the unions that were following the party line, that is, the executive council line, was sort of keep your mouth shut, and we just sort of had an agreement that we wouldn't be outspoken. And they were pretty candid about it. They said, we know you don't agree with us, and sometimes they'd say, we don't agree with them either, but, you know, that's policy, and that's it. The only other thing, and this is an interesting footnote in history, I think, the only real firefight we had with the labor movement, with the state fed, was right before I left, and it was on the issue of the Equal Rights Amendment. And Dave Spencer, we'd hired him the year before, and we had got a call from CWA, which was very strong, they had a very good local. They weren't any stronger there than they went anyplace else, but they'd been down to campus and with the summer schools. And a couple of the women in Terre Haute said, can you come over and do a program for us on the Equal Rights Amendment? We had no women on the staff. Dave and I, you know, we read up on ERA and we knew something, so we started calling around and we found, we had a woman on the staff of CWA for one. We had someone from the UAW, which at that point was disaffiliated. We found a community woman who was a member of whatever women's organization was around then. I'm not sure which ones had been formed and which ones hadn't at that particular point in time. This is the early 70s. But the AFL-CIO executive board had still had its ban on had its official position was anti-ERA. Much to the chagrin of all the female staff members, particularly in CWA and some of the more progressive unions. And so we said, you know, we can't refuse to put on a conference because of some stupid AFL-CIO policy. Well, we put one on for them. And this turned into, I sort of left Dave with all the splinters of this when I came up here. So it was right before I came up. We went to Terre Haute. They said, here's what we want. And they said, here are some suggested people to do it. And we wrote down the names, called the people who, of course, had other suggestions of people. And we had all these workshops worked out. And there were two guys organizing a women's conference, which you and I did here, as a matter of fact. And we put it all together. Well, pretty soon I got a call from a guy whose name I can't remember, but he was a real political Neanderthal. He was secretary treasurer of the Fed, mm-hmm. in any case. His name isn't important, I guess, at this point in time. And he said, we heard that you're doing this anti rah, rah, rah. I said, that's right. I wish I could remember his name. And he said, don't you think that they should get another point of view? And I said, what's the other point of view? Well, the anti-ERA arguments. And I said, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm willing to make a balanced presentation. You know, I have no problem with that. Who are we going to get? He said, well, would you put me on the program if I came over? I said, sure, I'll put you on the program. Well, that was the biggest mistake he ever made in his entire life. Because I called the women who want us to do the conference, and I said, here's what happened with they said, fine, oh, good, bring him, we'd like to hear from the AFL-CIO. They ate him alive. I mean, you can't believe what happened to that poor, it's lucky he got out of there alive. I mean, you know, it was a death on wheels. Well, this subsequently spread, and there's the good side and the bad side. The good side is that news of this conference sort of went through women's circles statewide, not just in the labor movement, but Dick Lugar, you've heard of Dick Lugar, was then mayor of Indianapolis. And his coordinator of women's programs called us up, Mary Jane Butters. Now, I remember her name for some reason, because Mary Jane Butters looked like the woman who at the time was playing Superwoman on television. The first time I met her in City Hall, which was a very nice building in Indianapolis, she had came in her sweats, and she had just been down in the police training room downstairs exercising, you know, real, for that time, we're talking the early 70s, she was like a zillion miles ahead of a lot of women on women's issues. But we helped them develop a program for the city employees in Indianapolis. And I sort of left all this for Dave. This is just as I was phasing out.
Would that be non-union?
No, actually, they had some. You see, this Public Employee Bargaining Act, which, oh, that probably should be in my Indiana story. I helped write it. we'll get back to that later. Okay. Let's stick with ERA. What evolved there was that because there was no public employee bargaining law at that point, they had various opinions of the attorney generals of the state of Indiana as to whether or not public employers were required to bargain. And the Democratic ones would say yes and the Republicans would say no, but there was a sufficient number of AFSCME people in various units of state government so that they had de facto recognition. They had no legal status, but they had de facto recognition. And Lugar, interestingly enough, was not all that much of a Neanderthal when it came to dealing with the labor groups in city government. I mean, he wasn't, you know, an extreme conservative Republican. He was more, his image was one of being a power hungry. He started Unigov. Unigov meant that he wanted to absorb
everything in Marion County, which was the county in which Indianapolis, and put them under one
regional,
which he succeeded in doing, by the way. He got the legislature to declare Unigov as being, and he ended up as the mayor of Marion County, as we used to say, which was his political base. I mean, he did great, you know.
Marion County?
Marion, yeah.
Next to Monroe?
No, Marion is north of. Indianapolis is about, and there's one county between Monroe, and then there's, I can't remember, Sullivan, and then Indianapolis is Marion County, yeah. There's one county between Bloomington and Indianapolis. But any case, that was the most troublesome thing. The state fed really got pissed at us for advocating for these women's groups that were getting feisty and obstreperous. And before I left, we'd run a conference like that in Kokomo, and one in, I mentioned Terre Haute, and maybe Fort Wayne or one of our other outposts of civilization. Could have been. No, it was up in the Keys area. It was either South Bend or East Chicago or someplace like that. Yeah. So they were really teed off at us for defecting from AFL-CIO policy. Now, it wasn't too long the AFL-CIO rescinded its opposition to ERA and finally figured out it had a few women members, and they were serious shit if they didn't, you know. But
well, in Michigan, there was a real split that, as I understand it, a lot of the Fed's opposition was in support of the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union, Myra Wolfgang, and some others, who strongly opposed it because they had based their unionism on protective legislation for women, and they feared its demise. And there was a big fight within the Michigan Fed with the CWA and the UAW women being very in favor of ERA, but Hotel Restaurant and some others opposing that change.
That could have been, but we didn't have enough hotel restaurant to count in Indiana, you know.
So I don't know.
No, they were really, it was really a... we had advisory committee meetings where the advisory committee would disintegrate into snarly arguments over us providing this kind of service. Some people alleging this is not labor education. And I said, since when is, you know, women's rights not labor education, for Christ's sake, if you don't believe in.
Were there similar stories on racism and civil rights issues in terms of labor ed?
No, except we would sit down with with the union people, all of whom were, we had no, I can't really say that we had any racist leadership at the state level, which is where we dealt with people, but we would have to sit down with the UAW people and talk about what we could call, Terry Connors taught a lot of classes on what we would now call consciousness raising, and for the lack of a better term, I can't remember what he used, but the whole thing was on race relations, you know. Why do you perceive other people who have dark skin or whatever to be inferior to you, kind of thing? And we'd try to think up artful ways of disguising the titles for these courses so people would come to them. So it was like we were all on the same side on the race issue. It was a question of how we got the rednecks to come along with us, you know, and what artful devices we used to get them into Terry's classes, because Terry used to do a lot of this stuff, and I did a lot more, as I do here, the hard core stuff rather than the soft core stuff, but we never really had any incidents where a union, in terms of state leadership or whatever, would give us a hard time about that.
Did they ask you to do a lot of those programs?
Oh yeah, we would talk about, you know, Dale, you're going to do one of the general sessions, for example, for the auto workers, and why don't you talk about what's happening to the labor force or something like that, and try to basically, we'd talk about how we tell them that having large numbers of poor black workers is pulls down everyone's ability to get additional income and stuff like that. So we'd sort of develop a strategy for how we did that. So that was really the race issue, the civil rights thing. Basically, we were all on the same side. The ERA thing, which was totally irrational, they somehow differentiated from civil rights law, which would include sex discrimination. They didn't believe in sex discrimination, but they didn't want ERA. Now, in some respects, you say, well, what in the hell? That's, you know, that's contradictory, and that was sort of the position we took.
somehow they didn't see it as contradictory. If we talked about women having equal rights in the job, we had no problem with any of them. You know, I mean, they're fine. We can say that. That's okay. We believe in women. That's like I took a black to lunch with me last year kind of attitude, you know.
Quick question. You mentioned the steel workers in southern Indiana. It sounded as though they represented lots of different people. Were some of those District 50, or what was the way that those became so much?
Well, toward the end it was. 50 came across, what, in the late 60s, early 70s came in?
Well, when it changed the name.
Yeah.
Oh, when did it come into steel?
Yeah.
Mid-60s.
Yeah, 67, 60. I remember Harry Lester, Harry Doherty, standing up at a meeting and saying, the steelworkers district is now, District 30 is now complete. He said, we have the Alka-Seltzer plant in South Bend and a condom factory in Louisville, Kentucky. That was the introduction to District 50 coming into the steelworkers. But yeah, we got a lot of non-steel. The core of, you see, the steelworker, there were two steelworker districts in Indiana. One of them was the one that 29 or 28 was attached to Chicago.
Okay.
That was Germano's district. And that was just two counties. It was Lake and St. Joe, or Lake and St. Joe, yeah. South Bend is in St. Joe. Everything else in Indiana, including the top layer of counties in Kentucky, were in District 30. And then District 25, I think it was, just as I left, they eliminated District 25, so Harry Doherty picked up everything in the Cincinnati-Dayton area, which had been a separate district. So then that was District 30, and now they've merged them all into one great big, Ohio has its own district. And
but anyways, the southern Indiana wasn't steel, but it was steel.
Along the river it was.
Okay.
Along the river they had quite a few steel worker locals across from Louisville and Evansville. There were steel worker locals down there, yeah.
Okay. And those were milling.
And Louisville, and you know, even on both sides of the river is what
Furnace
I'm saying.
And all those things.
Yeah, small mills, but a lot of fabrication, a lot of fabrication. And the core of it for District 30, of course, was in Indianapolis itself, where they had Diamond Chain and the companies that produce all this big, heavy equipment, you know, that you see out on work sites, the steam shovel, what we used to call steam shovels, diggers. The Diamond Chain stuff was all steel workers organizing. Yeah.
I'm familiar with the northern stuff, which is...
Which is a different district, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but
right.
You were servicing them.
Sort of.
Somebody else was, or nobody was?
Well, I used to go up and do stuff with 1010 and 1011 and those locals there. Mm-hmm. And I'd literally get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, eat breakfast, and teach a day class, and then sleep all afternoon and teach a night class and drive back to Bloomington, which was a real drill. I'd stop in, where the hell is Purdue? West Lafayette, There was a Holiday Inn that opened for breakfast at 6 o'clock, and I would drive from Bloomington to West Lafayette just as they were opening for breakfast, eat breakfast, drive up to Gary, teach a morning class, go over a register at the Gary Hotel, sleep until 6 o'clock in the afternoon, eat a quick dinner, and go teach another 2 hours for the afternoon for the day shift people. And then get in the car and drive back to Bloomington. So, it was fun and games.
And only after the time you were leaving did they create the regional centers?
Centers, basically what happened was Charlie Ellinger was finishing up his bachelor's degree, having gotten a number of credits from the resident program, which ended in 65. And he wanted to go part-time on our staff so he could finish up, and he did. And we anchored him in the library. We found him an office in the library in Marion County. And they made a terrific sacrifice for him to finish up his degree, and then he went on staff there doing Marion County. When we hired Keith and Dave, they came down
to Bloomington. This was the year before I left. We hired them, so I was there for a whole year when they were on staff. Actually, two, if you count the second part of it. And we trained Keith. We brought him down to campus for 1 year, and then we put him up in South Bend. And Dave stayed on campus to cover Evansville and the programming in Vincennes and Terre Haute and that area. So that was the first, if you don't count the Charlie Ellinger thing in Indianapolis, that was the first really regional center that we created. But then I had said Kokomo, Fort Wayne, et cetera, and as they got more staff. The next person to come on was,
attorney?
No. The guy who's in Indianapolis. Why can't I think of his
name? Jim Wallian.
Jim, sure. He just got finished his PhD in political science, and we put him up there with Charlie to be the coordinator, and then Charlie and he worked Indianapolis for years. And
also mentioned in that series we were going through, but we can stop now. That's a good point, too.
No, I don't care. That's
fine. I was going to say, other Indiana stories, if we're going to finish Indiana, would be Public Employment Act. And were you involved in the Right to Work campaign issues?
Well, Right to Work law was passed the year I came there, which was 57. It was repealed, about 6-8 years later, when we got a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature, which must have been the Johnson landslide.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Welch became governor. Then we had Brannigan following him, who was a conservative Democrat. It's the other way around. We had Brannigan, then we had Matt Welch. Because Matt Welch is the one I was on the his advisory committee for a state public employee advisor or law. It was pretty painless and not much political brouhaha about it at all. The Democrats had said in the election, we're going to repeal it if we get elected. And when they got elected, they did. And it just sort of went, it was like instant lightning. No, it wasn't a big surprise to anyone. They said, this is what we're going to do. And they did it. So it could have been, in effect, 8 years? Something like that, maybe. Not long.
It wasn't a big part of your job, the labor at
No, we did. We orchestrated some debates on it. During that election campaign, we had Dal Sells debating the guy who was the head of either the Indiana Manufacturers Association or the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. I think it was the Manufacturers Association, and we became the neutral vehicle to set up a series of debates, which were largely, rigged for our constituency. Okay. So, but that was about the extent of it. So it wasn't a big issue.
What about Public Employment Act?
Public Employee Act. Basically, when Matt Welch got in, he put together, because we all of us down there were so politically active. He asked me to serve on this committee. That didn't last terribly long because he wanted to move it through the legislature pretty fast, and there were a lot of conservatives in the legislature to make a very...
So you were on the committee?
Yeah, I was on the committee, not the committee, but he had a task force to make a recommendation to the legislature about what kind of law and to provide some...
So you were there as a university professor?
Oh, yeah. I was supposed to be one of the people providing expert guidance to the administration on this thing. And the funny part is, I wrote an article about this that got republished two places. One of them, I gave it as a paper for the Midwest, or whatever they call the regional IRRA meetings in Cincinnati, I think a couple of years before I came up here, telling the whole history of this thing.
I'd like to read that.
Sometime. Yeah, I'll dig out a copy and let you read it. And then it got reprinted in another paper, but it was in the... all the IRRA papers at that point, they reprinted in the Labor Law Journal, the one from Chicago, the CCHL. Yeah. That's in there. I can't remember the date. I can find it. It's in the file right by your rear end.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, that gave the whole history thing. To make a long story short, they lost the first round of votes on a generic law the first time it went through the legislature because it included teachers. Now, you have to listen to this very carefully. And right before I left for Michigan, the legislature, in what struck me as the most bizarre kind of thing imaginable, went back and pulled our recommendation apart, took teachers out of it, and all the arguments in the legislature was, do you want to see the nice, lovely, you know, woman who teaches your kids kindergarten, blah, blah, walking a picket line? What they ended up doing, John, was passing a law that covered teachers and left everyone else out. So the first teacher bargaining law in Indiana was a teacher-only law. Now, if you can figure out...
So just the opposite of what logic would have told you.
Exactly, yeah. And for 2 years, they had nothing but a teacher bargaining law, and then they passed a generic...
Without the right to strike?
Yeah, without the right to strike.
And the original one allowed the right to strike?
No. Well, we recommended the right to strike. I mean, we had a very liberal panel making this recommendation. And it, unlike the Michigan law, it covered state employees except those people who were directly employed as legislative aides and stuff like
so
that.
Civil service was
so,
good.
Yeah, civil service was a joke.
But anyways, they took teachers out and passed the teacher-only law.
Right, and left the other one sitting there for 2 years. And then about 2 years later, I'm not sure of the exact timing on this, they passed a general one. Then it was challenged in... The general one was challenged in the state Supreme Court and declared unconstitutional because it delegated the right to determine a violation to what amounted to the general counsel's office without any basically legal, that is, legal interference. So for all practical purposes, it killed the generic one. But not the teacher one. As a matter of fact, the first 2 or 3 years I was here, I was running back at their request, training people to do neutral work under the teacher law, and I was doing some fact-finding, and I was doing a little bit of arbitrating and things, which I normally don't do, but I was doing it in Indiana, and I think that lasted maybe 3 years. I recruited Rob Grosvenor to go down and help me do some stuff down there, because they literally put this teacher thing into effect, and then they had no history people operating in the public sector, and no neutrals developed, and that's the first time I met Dick, whatever his name was, Pegnetter, was down in Indiana. They brought him in from Iowa, and we were doing some case, I think, in Kokomo together, and I was doing the fact-finding, and he was doing an ARB or something like that, so that's the first time I ever met Pegnetter. But I went down and did quite a bit of fact-finding and teacher disputes after they got the law, and then I went down and did a couple training institutes for them. By that time, they sort of developed a cadre of people, and then they put people on the staff who were they had hired from other states as professionals, and they were sending their own fact-finders out, that is, people who were 40-hour-a-week fact-finders. So,
just 2 or 3 years ago, they did something again, which led to a bunch of Michigan folks going back down there for UAW and AFSCME to fight each other over who was going to get them.
Oh, I don't know.
A civil service?
Could be.
Law?
Yeah, could be. Yeah, they've patched some of it up a little bit.
Any other IU stories?
Not that I can think of.
What about Nile? Is that something I should ask you more about?
Well, no. Nile was sort of concurrent with our labor program, that is our resident program. And that was operating here, and I think I pointed out a couple of other universities, and I think it went on for 2 or 3 years when they had funding to do resident programs.
You think that'll do IU?
That'll do IU.
Why don't we call it quits for today?
Sounds good to me.